Like Wallace Stegner, Joan Frank reaches down deep into the wardrobe of living, dying, who we are in the face of nature, and the conflicts all humans experience one way or another. Make It Stay is Joan's latest work, and she talks about it with Rosemary Manchester in just a moment. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Our show today is bound by the inevitability of life and death and the roles each person and character plays in destiny's trajectory. Mary Ames Mitchell joins me later in the hour in a conversation about The Purple Cowhouse and other tales of eccentricity. As she searches for her estranged father, her recent memoir reads like a historical mystery. And Barbara Quick is here with her review of Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies. Please stay with us for the hour. It's a novel idea. Make It Stay is a slim volume, but richly structured with narrative impact. Before we join Rosemary and Joan, let's listen to Joan Frank read from her most recent work of fiction, Make It Stay.
Police have a name for a practice in the world of retail theft, when a clerk seems to ring up a sale but secretly collects the cash. A pocket case, they call it. The clerk punches a key that opens the register drawer without recording the charge, at the same time announces the amount due. The customer will tend to pay more attention to the clerk's voice chiming with the sound of the opening drawer, handing the clerk his money. The clerk makes correct change, bags the item, and after the customer has left, pockets the money. Neil told me the police nickname. For all I know, it may be impossible to carry off any more. Computer registers are worlds more sophisticated. Employers keep surveillance cameras. Integrity shoppers cruise retail floors to test employee honesty. But in an earlier era, the scam was doable, with relative discretion and ease. And Tilda did it. At first, a little. Then, a lot. Cass Medford grew alarmed, she told Neil, when inventory numbers began contradicting figures for receivables. Small disparities weren't uncommon, but this series' steady climb caught the Alaska manager's attention. They instructed Cass to investigate at once. She said nothing to any employee, but arranged, without delay, to spy. It turned out to be as sorrowfully simple as standing outside the bookstore's front window, just back of the line of vision from within. It was one of those afternoons the townspeople cherish about autumns here. Sky a deep, aching blue, motes of gold in the air, so lovely. Cass allowed to Neil she had considered taking the day off. Leaves had begun to flush crimson, wine, umber, days filled with a warm sugar smell. Around and through lazed scents of cola, hot pretzels, smoke from leaf fires, still legal then, cut grass, geraniums, tips of trees barely stirred. In the hills, the vines had given up their precious row and turned to ridge upon brimming ridge of tarnished gold. Gardens hung heavy with their last great loads, tomatoes, eggplants, green peppers. Light felt spun, the color of whipped honey, hovering over the stillness. In the mall, mothers tugged little kids clutching orange and black promotional balloons from the back-to-school sales. Cass walked the long way round the buildings, through the parking lot, so as not to be seen from the book stash display window. Nearing the store, she passed a small boy trudging behind his mother. As they walked, she heard the boy declare with firmness, "I'm ready. I'm ready to be grown." Cass watched a harried, middle-aged man buy an atlas, probably for a teenager beset by homework, she thought. He paid in cash. She watched Tilda smile and thank the man, send him on his way with his purchase, and then, agog, Cass watched the worn green bills slip into Tilda's pants pocket. Tilda then busied herself straightening items on the counter, and when she must have decided no one was near, stopped and transferred the bills from her pocket into her blobby Navajo tote bag, a bag Cass had always detested, heaped on the floor near her feet. She entered the store quietly, nodding in what she hoped looked like a typically offhand acknowledgement to Tilda, still presiding at the front counter, and phoned the police from the back room. When the two uniformed officers showed up, blue-black uniforms, silver buckles clinking as they walked, a genital jumble of nightsticks and guns, Tilda, still manning the front counter, directed them jovially to the back room. "Hey, Jimmy. Hey, Ralph. How's it hanging?" Cops cruised the stores all the time. Security inspections, auction tickets, toy drives, boredom. In those days, you came to know everyone in minutes. Tilda knew these people's names, their kids' and grandkids' names and ages. She kept track of spousal quarrels, vacation plans, bowling scores, barbecue sauce secrets, coffee, a little chocolate. But when Jimmy and Ralph and Cass emerged together from the back, looking grave under the fluorescent ceiling lights, Cass told Neil she never forgot the way Tilda's face changed. It got dark. Her face, I mean. Dark as if it would explode. And her eyes, their color, kind of yellow-green like flames. I felt as if we were closing in on an animal. Tilda stood still and silent while poor Jimmy and Ralph, miserable with their sworn duty, mumbled her rights. Her eyes never left those of the horrified Cass. Then Cass watched the officers accompany Tilda out into the warm, vanilla-smelling afternoon to drive her in the squad car to the station. They flanked her, Cass remembers, but did not touch her. Shortly thereafter, Neil received his call.
People describe you as a writer's writer.
That's a lovely compliment.
And I want all readers to take note that when you hear that it's a writer's writer, that means that the writing has passed a certain test of excellence, which makes other writers pick up on it and study the work to see how she does it. I've read Make It Stay 3 times.
Wow.
And I expect to read it many, many more times because
wow.
I can open it any place and just read beautiful writing. You choose your words with such care.
Oh, thank you, Rosemary.
Yeah.
You know, it's really a novella.
Yes.
So I hope readers will be drawn to it by knowing first that it's a fast read and
yes.
it's a short read.
Yes.
It's about 160-some pages.
Yes.
And yet I do believe and hope that it carries the impact of a 400-page novel by creating a dense world with a palpable, sensuous atmosphere and fully dimensionalized characters who I hope will haunt the reader for a long time to come.
The book concerns two couples, a quartet.
Correct.
And at first I visualized it as a square or a rectangle, and then I thought, no, it's out of balance. It's a bunch of triangles cobbled together. I mean, the relationship is cobbled together. The two men are best friends.
That's true. So that's one couple.
That's one couple. Each of the couples have a stable marriage.
Right. So that's two more.
Yeah. The women are uncomfortable with each other.
Very true.
Yes. And they're... that's the rub. Yes.
It's true.
And as the plot develops, you see how that throws things out of kilter.
It's true.
Now, the men are so interesting. Let's talk about Neil.
Okay.
Neil is a wonderful guy. He cooks. He gardens.
He flings himself at life, does Neil.
Yes.
With all four limbs. He rides a bicycle. He helps people in his profession, which is an attorney for vineyard workers. And he loves to cook and garden. Yes, he's passionate about making life better.
Mm-hmm.
And he's generous and thoughtful and immensely kind. And I'm deeply, deeply fond of him, as I am of everyone in this book. He's not without certain, he's blinkered in some regards. But that blinkeredness perhaps comes from his generosity as a friend.
Yes, and some from his upbringing.
Right.
And he is a Scot.
That's right.
Is charming.
Thank you. Yeah. I find the Scottish accent one of the most musical and beautiful I have ever heard. My husband watches soccer, and there's always a Scottish commentator on the show named Bobby McMahon. Bobby! And I could listen to Bobby talk all night. It's a lovely musical accent that I can't pretend to imitate, but I'm mesmerized by. So I wanted to throw just a few twists and tangs of that into this.
You gave us some clues on the pronunciation, which was charming.
A little bit, yeah.
Now, Neil is best friends with Mike. They couldn't be more different.
Absolutely true. They meet as young men. Mike has a hand in possibly saving Neil's life, although we'll never know whether it was that dramatic, in an incident in the South Seas. So everyone who hasn't read this book, if you want to take a little trip to Tahiti in the very beginning, that's where you'll go. In gratitude and admiration for Mike's prowess in his work, Neil, I think, bonds early and wants to always be there for his friend, because that's the way friendships work in Neil's mind. And Mike, in his way, is just as loyal.
Mm-hmm. And his business is tropical fish.
That's correct.
Now, you seem to know an enormous amount about tropical fish.
Oh, this was so fun, Rosemary. I didn't really know a lot when I started out, but it occurred to me that that was what Mike should do. He needed to do something related to science and something that sort of clashed with his Tarzan physique, something that didn't exactly make sense at first glance. And so I made him a passionate aficionado of all matters to do with fish. And it was delicious fun to research this. I went to the library, I came home with stacks of books, and I found quite quickly that there's an entire world out there, a shimmering, sparkling world of people who love this, who love rearing fish, learning about them, breeding them, tracking them, exchanging with other such aficionados. It was delicious fun. And my task was to get just enough authenticity into the description of Mike's world and work, not to overwhelm the reader with didacticism. But the colors, the exoticism, and this sort of fragile quality of life that the fish represent all appealed powerfully to me instinctively. And I had a great time with library books. And how may I plug the Sonoma County Library for the billionth time?
I know, they're wonderful.
They are always there for me, and they are instrumental to...
And they know everything.
Yes, they do.
Yes. Mike's lifestyle is atrocious. He never exercises, he eats badly, he drinks too much, smokes too much. And the contrast between Mike and Neil is very interesting.
Well, physically, they probably look something like, not Mutt and Jeff exactly, but a couple of extremely opposed physical types, maybe olive oil and wimpy, because Neil is tall and skinny and he has frizzy red hair. And Mike is enormous and burly, ape-like, in fact, and is florid and booming. Neil is reserved and introspective. They couldn't be more different. Mm-hmm. And don't all of us know somebody like Mike at some point in all our lives?
Yes.
We've all known people who were so much bigger than life. And on the one hand, you admire them, and on the other, they give you a headache.
Yes, and you're in despair for them.
Absolutely.
You know that they're doing all the wrong
They're digging
the
a grave
thing.
With a fork.
Yes, they are.
And also with tobacco products and alcohol. And you can't change them, and you have to love them, and you do tear your hair.
Mm-hmm. Neil doesn't even try to change Mike. I think
it's possible that men understand that hopelessness quite quickly. And I think maybe, and this is a huge generalization, I hope nobody comes after me for it, but they're more inclined to not squander energy on what is obviously not going to be effective.
Well said. Well said. Now, Mike is married to Tilda.
Right.
It seems a strange relationship. And
it is.
I appreciated that you didn't try to explain it, because you look at many couples and their relationship is can't be explained.
Cryptic. Often many couples' relationships are cryptic, and often relationships start out, as I hope is shown with Mike and Tilda, as a kind of a on-the-spot need fulfillment.
Yes.
Mike needs a partner and a lover, and he's so odd that he probably scares away most of the women in his orbit. Mm-hmm. Tilda also needs someone and probably is attracted to Mike's wildness. Mm-hmm. So, and they're young when they get together.
Yes.
So what starts out as two personae morphs as those people age and various identities are removed, like skin, like a snake skin. Mm-hmm. And they become, by default, what they become. Let me add that one of the things I was trying to explore in this story, because I am the age I am and have witnessed lives evolve improbably over many years' time, is the quality of inevitability. Inevitability interests me as a quality of people's lives' trajectories. And by inevitability, I mean two things. One is that once viewed, we can't imagine that thing, that life, unbeing. It's got to be because we've seen it and it must be what it is. And the second part of inevitability in my mind is not being able to imagine it any other way, even though it's weird and strange, that there's a, somehow as if a big invisible hook were drawing that life forward or that trajectory forward along the difficult and painful path it must take. Mm-hmm. These are not provable qualities, but they're qualities one senses. They're often personality related. One feels that personalities drive an apparent inevitability about lives. I felt that very much about Mike and Tilda.
And you have a wonderful passage near the end of the book where you, you're not exactly describing them, but you speak of drifting down the Niagara River.
Right.
That is such a powerful image.
One of the issues that much of this book deals with is the passing of time and aging and how we marvel at the fact that we are indeed mortal. The time is in fact passing. As Martin Amis once said, death is not a rumor, and that we are all moving softly, slowly, but with increasing speed along the Niagara River, which was a brilliant poem by the Marin poet Kay Ryan, which I've cribbed the theme from, and with Kay's permission, thank goodness. We all pretend that it's not happening, but it's happening. And often we confront it too late. I wanted to think about these things while I still could, and while the character still could. That the character being Ray, who narrates this story, slightly unreliably because she has a passionate stake in keeping her husband.
Yes. And before we talk about Ray, we should at least mention that Mike and Tilda have a daughter.
That's right.
Named Addie, who is incredibly beautiful, brilliant, a wonder child.
Against all odds.
Yes.
And I have reason to stand by this fact that some people can give birth to an exquisite being who is wonderfully well-adjusted, kind, gifted, high-achieving, gorgeous to look at, no apparent damage or troubles, and yet the two people this person came from may be absolutely atrocious as characters or as simply as figures to look upon.
Mm-hmm.
It happens. Mm-hmm. And that was something I also wanted to lay open in this work.
And we all celebrate Addie in the book. She's wonderful.
Good.
Now let's talk about Rachel, the narrator, who in a sense holds the whole thing together since it's her story.
It is.
Yeah.
She. It's very tricky because the story is almost a fourth-hand telling. Ray tells what is told her by Neil. She takes pains to point that out at various junctures in the narrative. But of course, what's really happening is Ray is inserting her own imagined particulars and fleshing out the story for readers and also deciding what to withhold from time to time to make sure that, if she can, her marriage is not threatened by the traumatic evolution of Tilda and Mike's own lives. There's something about Mike that I want to say, too. Late in the book, he is called a gondolier. And the funny thing is, I never really did construct this consciously, but one of the things that inspired me when I began to write the story was a piece of music by Tchaikovsky called a barcarolle, which is a short, simple melody. And barcarolle means, as a musical form, music to be sung or played in a barca or a gondola. I don't know if barca is the word. I just made that up. But it's a gondolier's song. And the melody that inspired me was a simple theme, repeated, and then a gentle riff goes on a little journey and comes back and repeats the simple theme. And I hoped, when I began, to try to effect something like that. At the beginning of the book, you'll see the phrase, "Now we're beginning." And later, much later, you'll see, "Now we are ending." And it's not that everyone is dying, but that I'm closing the lens. Rachel is closing the lens on this simple story, which I hope functions in a way like that piece of music. Music, to me, is what stories and voices finally are. And I hope this will count in people's minds as a memorable melody.
A very, very important part of this book is the setting. You've set it in Sonoma County.
Absolutely have.
And a lot of place, real and imagined place names.
That's right. Yes. I created a town very much like Santa Rosa with a different name and relied on many people's memories and my own sensuous happiness with the area. It makes a wonderful setting. And frankly, I do believe that place is character.
Oh, yes.
I believe that it enters all of our bodies and stays with us forever and shapes the way we perceive the world every minute we're breathing. Mm-hmm. And this county offers such marvelous backdrops. The austerity of the vineyards in winter, the lushness in summer, the quality of the air, the nearness of the sea.
Yes. The microclimates.
Indeed, yes. Indeed. The saline smells and the fruit and the vegetables and the quality of light. One could write a book about the light alone.
Yes.
So it's a feast for an author.
It is. And so many of the local writers are making the most of that.
Absolutely.
Of this wonderful place that we live.
Yep.
There's a drama with our beauty.
There is drama.
Yeah.
There are seasons, certainly.
There's stories here.
But what the beauty always says to me is, you know, you're alive. You're alive. You're alive for this brief, brief, precious tenure in this extraordinary place. Mm-hmm. You know, hold it close. Unpack it. Mm-hmm. Dream about it. Speak it. Sing it. You can't celebrate it enough or listen or too closely or watch too closely.
Mm-hmm. And if there is a, quote, theme, unquote, to your book, I would say it's exactly what you're saying, that it's about life.
It is.
Yes.
It's about holding life close while you are awake and aware. These sound like terrible cliches, but they are arrived at through the schools of hard knocks that many years offer. That was a cliche, too.
Yes.
Oh, well.
Well, We're being very careful not to give away the plot,
right?
Because it's so well crafted, and it really smacks the reader upside of the head when it comes to the part of the book where the drama and the crises and the various things that occur to these four people.
It's true.
So we're tiptoeing around that so that the reader can discover those things for themselves.
I hope the reader will be drawn through by the descriptions and the strange events. And again, a quality of inevitability that pulls at you like the Niagara River, I hope.
Yes, yes. I think that will happen. And
thank you.
I know that people are going to be very keen.
I hope so, dear.
On this book.
Thanks so much.
Right. It's always a pleasure.
Oh.
One more question.
Yeah.
I asked you this question last time you were here, so I'll be persistent. Early in your career, you were in the Peace Corps in Senegal.
That's right.
And I'm waiting for that book.
Oh, thank you for reminding me. I'm going to have to get down and set myself to it. I'm busy still shepherding two other children into the world. I have a new novel called You've Got the Same Pants to Get Happy In. It may be shortened to Same Pants, we'll see. And I have another novel called The Outlook for Earthlings, and I am patiently persistently, steadfastly looking for publishing homes for these two.
Yes.
I'm very proud of them both, particularly Same Pants, because I think it's funny. And being funny is not something I have done very much of in the past. So I'm hoping someone's going to get a whiff of it and say, yes, this will do. Thank you very much. So once those are safely sent off with their names sewn into the backs of their collars and their lunch packed, then I'll start the new thing. And thank you for reminding me about West Africa.
And I'm always interested in what you're reading.
Oh, yes. I have a new crush. Can I talk about him?
Of course.
Oh, goody. His name is Simon Van Booy. That's spelled B-O-O-Y. It looks like a Dutch name. And in the Denver airport, desperate to find a book to get me across the country to Washington, D.C., I combed every book in the stacks and had the impossible good luck to find a collection of stories called The Secret Lives of People in Love by this handsome young man, looks like Johnny Depp, named Simon Van Booy. And the writing is astonishing. It is so beautiful. I've decided that now all the readings I'm going to give from Make It Stay in the Bay Area, I'm going to bring my crush with me and read from his work to show people that writers do champion each other. They
yes.
are in love with beautiful, important new work, and they will do whatever it takes to say good things about it and get the word out into the world. Van Booy writes like an angel. He writes in a way that acknowledges the tragedy of the world, but with an undercurrent of persistent belief in people's capacities for love, hope, and redemption. And they're very hard won, but they occur. And his language is, as I say, close to poetry, but not the kind that hurts your head. It goes easily, goes down fast and sweetly and well. And he says in the back of this particular collection a couple of things that I think are lovely. He talks about MFA programs for writing. Mm-hmm. He says, I feel that while it's possible that a student in a graduate program for creative writing may not publish any books in the long term, the ability to craft stories and develop voice will inevitably make them more understanding parents, deepen their friendships, and lead to emotional rooms within that were previously locked or hidden from view. And any stories or memoirs a person crafts in their lifetime will live on long after they have died. In some ways, the ability to write is the opportunity to live forever and to love forever. I think it's very beautiful.
It's wonderful.
And it makes me want to be more generous as a writer and as a teacher of mm-hmm. writing mm-hmm. and as a colleague of other mm-hmm. writers.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the right idea, and his writing itself is just angelic. So I urge mm-hmm. you to look at his work. There are two story collections. One's called The Secret Lives of People in Love. Another's called Love Begins in Winter. And the first novel he ever wrote is called Everything Beautiful Began After. He has themes you'll recognize, but you'll never be sorry. Keep it by the bed and let the good vibes enter you while you sleep.
Mm-hmm. And could we hear his name one more time?
Simon Van Booy, B-O-O-Y.
Right.
Lovely young man.
Yeah. You yourself have an MFA from Warren Wilson.
I do,
yes.
Which was a feast.
Yes.
A feast.
And
I was taught by working writers who are generous, endlessly smart, and kind.
Mm-hmm.
Not three qualities that necessarily occur in one working writer mm-hmm. very often.
Mm-hmm.
And we immersed in learning how to read very, very, very closely and learning certain tricks of craft, the how of writing. I'm still not convinced that you can teach talent. I don't think you can. But you can teach dogged persistence and a willingness to learn and learn and learn. And the energy of drive is pretty much 9/10 of the ball game.
Yes.
You've got to be so fanatically committed that
yes.
almost that you're like an Olympic athlete in training mm-hmm. for an right. endless Olympics.
One marathon after another.
It never stops. And you're only as good as the last event.
That's true. Oh, Joan, I do so love talking with you.
And it's so fun to talk with you, Rosemary.
It's a joy to have you here in the studio. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in.
Thank you so much.
And we wish you all the best with your new novel, Make It Stay.
Thanks again.
Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Joan Frank on her most recent novel, Make It Stay. Let me share with you Kay Ryan's poem, which inspired Joan so much, The Niagara River. As though the river were a floor, we position our table and chairs upon it, eat, and have conversation. As it moves along, we notice, as calmly as though dining room paintings were being replaced, the changing scenes along the shore. We do know, this is the Niagara River. But it's hard to remember what that means. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang. We'll be right back. Following on Simon Van Boy's sentiments, Mary Ames Mitchell crafts her family stories. And like Jeanette Wall's The Glass Castle and Clayne Heyward in her memoir, The Hypocrisy of Disco, Mitchell in her recent memoir, The Purple Cowhouse and Other Tales of Eccentricity, liberates herself by exploring the undiscovered and heartbreaking realities within her own family.
Mary Ames Mitchell, The Man in the Purple Cowhouse. It's a memoir. It reads like a cultural history almost of Southern California, where you grew up, Pasadena, in a time that if we went there now, we might not even recognize. What inspired you to write this book?
I hadn't seen my father in 13 years. He had told his family we were part of a big conspiracy. We weren't to talk to him anymore. And after 13 years, I was 42 years old. I was wondering what happened to him. I was a big girl by then. I knew I couldn't wait anymore for him to come find me. I was living in San Francisco at the time, and I went down to Southern California, assuming he was somewhere in Santa Monica. And after 2 weeks, I found out what had happened to him. When I came back and started telling my friends about it, they all said, Mary, you have got to write that down. I wasn't a writer. I was a graphic designer. But I sat down in a Macintosh 512, and I wrote 50 pages just describing what it was. And that sat in the computer for about 2 years. And then I started to build up the story.
It seems like you had a lot of rich material, certainly from your own memory of growing up. But it seems like maybe your family keeps records and your family has a deep history.
That's true. I have a family tree now that's over 60 pages long. And in a way, there's almost too much. And I think I had this feeling I needed to put everything in this book as if it were the only book I had ever going to write. But we do. My family is from a history of writers, and I have lots of books that they have written.
And we can talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Let's focus first on this book, The Man in the Purple Cowhouse and Other Tales of Eccentricity. At the heart of this story really seems to be the story of a father and a daughter. You describe your family growing up, and in a sense, there's a normalcy about your family. You take vacations and seem to be vibrant, but maybe have that streak of eccentricity, especially as it's exhibited by your dad. And maybe as a child, that didn't seem so strange, and maybe it seemed normal. But as you depicted in this book, in retrospect, that maybe there were some things about your dad and your mom that you didn't see as a child, but as an adult, you were able to recognize what was maybe some problematic issues.
I think we all, when we're small, think that the world as we see it is normal. And then when, particularly when I moved away from college, and you look back and you see other environments and you start to realize what was unique to your life compared to everybody else's. And I could tell on the street where we lived that my parents were different than the sort of normal of that street. But on the other hand, Southern California was filled with artists and entrepreneurs, with Hollywood and everything. So there were also many, many other inspiring people around us that I also appreciated once I moved away was unique to Southern California.
Well, why don't you describe the Purple Cow House?
The Purple Cow House was built in 1926 for a big capitalist. It was, I think it was 15,000 square feet and 23 rooms. It was in a nice part of Pasadena near the Huntington Hotel, which is kind of the icon of Pasadena at the time, on 2.5 acres, surrounded by other houses similar to that house. The house that is the headquarters for the Tournament of Roses was built by the same architect. But at the time when my family bought it, which was in 1952, I believe, when I was 6 months old, it was a white elephant. People didn't want big houses like that. So we bought this house for $30,000. It was in fairly good shape, but it came with furniture, huge, oversized furniture. My parents were moving into it from a small studio. So we moved into this big house, and I think my dad had visions of Camelot.
And so this is the first place you really remember.
I only lived there technically until I was 3, but we owned it until I was 13. And from the time we moved out to the time that we didn't own it, I don't want to give away my story, my dad still took care of it, and we would go down with him on weekends as he would water the plants and take care of it, and we would play in it like a huge, as I say in my book, a huge museum, as if it didn't have any guards. It had a huge ballroom in the basement, which my dad laid out a Lionel train set, and we would play with that, and we would run through the rooms. It had secret passages, and it had hidden safes, and there was a garden in one corner, a place you could play. So it was a fun place to be.
Yet this location of this huge mansion seemed to also be an anchor point for your dad's paranoia.
Well, it started, the reason I called it the Purple Cow House is because when we bought it, my parents originally intended to subdivide the property. It was 2.5 acres. The house was in one corner, and he intended to divide it into 5 lots, keep the corner where the house was, and sell the rest to pay for the part that we kept. And of course, the neighbors didn't like that. So my dad, trying to be humorous, discovered that it was still zoned for farm animals. So we put a cow on the front lawn, tied it to a big oak tree. The brownie troop named the cow Bossy. I think her technical name was cow number 106. But then this feud developed over the zoning laws, and that was my father's big cause, was this zoning issue, which he fought for 12 years.
And as he became more and more obsessed with fighting this battle, it seems like he was spiraling the family in a different direction.
A lot of what my dad wanted is actually come to pass in Pasadena, but it was the way that he approached it. He would lose his temper. He would argue for his cases by himself in court without representation, and it just became obsessive for him and a symbol against authority, against government, against anybody telling him what to do.
How was your mom during all of this? Because your mom and dad eventually split, and it seems like it became a very difficult situation for her, too.
My mom, who grew up in England, didn't handle any emotional variance very well. If anyone lost their temper or raised their voice or got overly emotional, she would do what she could to either quiet it, suppress it, ignore it. So she didn't like this. She was actually pretty tolerant of his causes in that, you know, her family had been very actively in social activists. So she was understanding of what he was trying to do, just not about the way. And then when he would start to turn on her, in one case, she asked him outright, I think this is a symbol of other motives for you. And he turned on her and said, oh, you're just like all the rest. So, yeah, it wasn't easy for her.
You go about solving this mystery. You set the scene of your childhood with your family growing up in Southern California. But then you grow up and your dad becomes less and less an active part in your life until you go on this search for him. And it's in some ways kind of heartbreaking to see you go on that journey. And I wonder, what was that like for you? Probably many of our listeners have drifted from people they love. And your dad was missing, essentially. And what made you finally decide, I have to find my dad?
There was a battle back and forth. There were times where I was really angry at him because so much of what he was doing and his causes were subtracting from me having my own life. But every girl needs a dad, and every girl wants to be hugged and treasured. And he did that. He made me feel feminine. He made me feel wanted. He really wanted me to be able to express myself. And in that way, he succeeded, even though he's, you know, kind of turned into himself. But that really wasn't until maybe I was 10 or 12. So I had a good probably 12 years of the good fathering alongside the eccentric father. That's not so true with my brothers. Yeah, there was this battle back and forth. And there was a little bit of a relief when he told me he didn't want to see me anymore because it was just so hard to please him at that point. But then you realize, okay, he's never going to change. And I think when I was in my 20s, I thought people could change. And when I was in my 40s, I realized, you know, people probably aren't going to change. And if they're odd in one way, they're probably going to get even odder the older they get. So if I really wanted to know what happened, I was just going to have to be a big girl and go look for him.
So you went yourself through a period of time of saying, he doesn't want to see me, I'm not going to see him.
Right. Yeah. You know, bit by bit, I realized that I missed him. And I also just constantly, I think this is true with everybody who has he did have an alcohol problem. I never saw him drunk, but certainly it's similar to people who have alcoholics or anybody. You keep wanting them to go back to normal. You just keep hoping that day is going to happen where they're going to take a turn and go back to normal. And when I went to look for him, I wasn't expecting him to be normal all of a sudden. And I even was prepared for him to reject me and say, please go away. I had two friends who lost their father before they were able to, a similar thing had happened. And they didn't get to see their dad. So I wanted to make sure that that didn't happen to me.
In the book, you address that your dad may have been or was gay, but at a time when that's not something that a lot of men came out with, and a lot of men did get married and have children. And so how did that become revealed to you?
Well, he did things that I found strange.
Like wearing a Speedo bathing suit.
Right. We had spent a bunch of time in Italy, and he bought a very tiny little bathing suit. And he kept him. He was very fit. He had a very nice physique. I contrasted it to Popeye with the big shoulders and the tiny waist. And he would wear this tiny suit. And it was embarrassing for a teenager during a time when other people were wearing what we call baggies, you know, large Hawaiian print shorts at the beach. And we spent a lot of time at the beach. I just thought it was kind of weird. So that was the one thing that I noticed myself. It really wasn't until I started to research him after he disappeared and started to talk to my mom that she revealed to me that their sex life had been almost non-existent. I asked my mom, well, then how were my brothers and I conceived? And she said, well, in your language, I just jumped his bones one night. So it was over time that I realized there was probably. So then what I wanted to know was about the split in his personality, because it did seem like there was a time where he was just conflicted between the different sides of himself. And so that kind of, I won't ever know for sure, but I think the fact that I think he had his sexual kind of conflict between who he should be and who he wanted to be helped also explain to me this kind of split in his personality.
Just trying to deal with his own reality in a world that was not necessarily supportive of that reality. Mm-hmm. I think probably that was a fate of a lot of people in that time period.
That's my understanding, he wanted a nice, normal life. He wanted a family. He wanted all these things. And absolutely, in the 50s, you couldn't have that out in the open. And his father had been a big football player and a big businessman, and he'd grown up in Chicago where, you know, all these things. And so, yeah, if to come out would not have been a possibility for him at all.
In the story, you reveal your dad's life as you discovered it once you had moved away, and he may have achieved somewhat of a normal life or negotiated terms that worked for him, even though on the outside it might not have seemed normal. But he did have friends and routines and maybe settled into something unusual and not what we would consider normal, but was stable for him.
Yes, I think that's a really important message that I hope that I have portrayed. And I think Jeanette Wall was trying to portray that in her book, The Glass Castle, was that this life of homelessness wasn't, it was something he was actually choosing. It wasn't just he wasn't a victim. He had money in the bank and he wanted this. He liked the challenge of seeing how he could live without being dependent on anybody for anything. And he had friends. He went every morning to Norm's Coffee Shop in Santa Monica, and he had the same seat. He was sitting there for 18 years. He had friends that missed him when he disappeared, and the regulars that all came there, and he was very content.
And did that, as a daughter, did you actually feel some degree of happiness for your dad at that point?
I did. I look back now and wish I had investigated a little more of what had been going on those 13 years. At the time, I really just couldn't face it. But no, I was very, very glad that I found that out.
We're talking about the man in the Purple Cow House, Mary Ames Mitchell's memoir and story of her life and her father's life and your family, essentially, because you have some great archival material going back to Chicago, and it really is a family history. I hope your family appreciates that. And I want to talk about a couple of other things, Mary. I want to talk about Peach Plum Press and how it fits in with this book and your take on the world.
Well, my career is a graphic designer, and as I've worked on this book, and then I've also written a book now about my mom and her family. And as I've done all of this research on both of my mom's family and my dad's family, I've just realized every family has all these stories, and it's so easy to self-publish. There's no reason you have to publish 1,000 copies. You can do 10. And I've done a lot of talks to Mayflower Society groups and the Daughters of the American Revolution. And the most popular one is when I give this talk about how they can publish their family story for $10 on one of these self-publishing sites. That's what everyone wants to do. They want, it doesn't have to be a famous story. It can just be whatever their story is and have it in book form and be able to leave it for their family and share it with their children and their other relatives. So with the graphics background, I thought, well, the one thing that they need is to know how to market their book. And so many of them don't know how to do the just the mechanical part of creating the mechanical that they need to upload online and their cover and how to do some kind of a promotion like a bookmark or a website, which there's so many places that will sort of follow you through, but you just need a little bit of guidance. So I started Peach Blonde Press so I can not only help my friends publish their books, but also be able to maybe even republish some of my family's books. My great-grandmother wrote two wonderful kind of Jane Austen-type novels that take place in Minnesota. And they're, of course, out of print. They're wonderful. And there would be no reason to publish it in a big way, but it would be very nice to be able to publish more copies.
Everybody has a story to tell. And you have a rich family history that where it sounds like people loved to tell stories. And so how wonderful. And some of the proceeds of Peach Plum Press go to COTS. Is that it?
All the proceeds from The Man in the Purple Cowhouse go to COTS. And COTS is Committee on the Shelterless in Petaluma. And they just have wonderful programs to help people pick themselves back up and get back into a nice, normal life. And Petaluma is not too far from me. So, and then some of the, when I first launched the Purple Cowhouse in Pasadena, we gave all those proceeds to Union Station, which does a similar thing down in Pasadena.
How was the book received down in Pasadena?
Well, I don't want to brag, but...
you get to.
Romans, which is the main bookstore, sort of the center of Pasadena. It's an old bookstore. They had my book signing there, and they told me it was the largest turnout they'd ever had, except for somebody who was famous. So I was happy.
That's very good.
And they had wonderful people that showed up. The man who'd been in charge of the demolition of the big house was there, and people who had lived in the neighborhood and had ridden their bicycles around there, people who'd lived across the street. All these people came out of the woodworks to come and find out what happened to that purple cowhouse.
And that's what was a lovely aspect of the book, that it was both personal but revealed a wonderful snapshot in time of that part of Southern California. So, Mary Ames Mitchell, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You can find The Purple Cowhouse by Mary Ames Mitchell at Book Passage in Corte Madera, online at Amazon, or order it directly from the author, and the proceeds will benefit COTS, the Committee for the Shelterless, in Petaluma. Finally today, Barbara Quick offers us her review of Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies.
The scene that opens Hilary Mantel's brilliant new novel, set in and around the royal court of Henry VIII, Bring Up the Bodies, was presaged in the final lines of her hugely successful novel from 2009, Wolf Hall. Volumes 1 and 2 of what will be a trilogy, both of these beautifully told chronicles focus on the political career of the counselor and confidant to the much-married Henry, Thomas Cromwell, known to most of us by the telling portrait made of him by the official painter of the Tudor household, Hans Holbein. My guess is that in addition to the gobs of painstaking research she did, Mantell stared at this portrait until it yielded up the secrets of the flesh-and-blood man who posed for it, his ruthlessness and his humanity, his ambition, his tenderness, the chip on his shoulder as a commoner trying to make his way among members of the nobility, the politician who grasped the game with the brilliance of a chess master, the devoted husband and father, the friend who remembered those he loved and those who wronged them, the hugely rich and powerful man who knew that his life could be extinguished by his king as easily as the flame of a candle pinched between royal thumb and forefinger, and with as little regret. Mantell won the 2009 Man Booker Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction for Volume 1 of the tale, Wolf Hall. Without doubt, she will win similar well-deserved accolades for Bring Up the Bodies, which is everything that historical fiction can and should be. In other words, Hilary Mantel has simply written a brilliant literary novel that happens to be set in the historical past. Reading her prose is like watching an Olympic equestrian. We sense the author's oneness with her story, just as we sense the rider's oneness with the horse. Every movement flows with economy, elegance, and grace. Mantell handles point of view like no other writer I've ever read. It can shift back and forth seamlessly within a single paragraph from the third-person singular to the interiority of the first-person plural, from he to we, creating a rich intimacy between the reader and Cromwell. We see the world as he sees it, and we also see him. The story told in Bring Up the Bodies takes place over the course of little more than 1 year, specifically the year in which Anne Boleyn went from being the king's own darling to having her head chopped off by a French swordsman especially hired by Henry for that purpose. Mantell excels at rendering the nuanced interactions of conversation, the elaborate verbal choreography as individuals, both male and female, climb onto the balance and weigh their relative power. Unlike so many lesser writers, she understands how the political always occurs within the context of the personal. Her Cromwell is a witness to history and also a player who works mostly behind the scenes to make things happen. In some ways, he is a deus ex machina walking through the pages of Bring Up the Bodies, pragmatic about what he must do to serve the interests of his king, interests that Cromwell can often see much more clearly than the monarch himself, who is as sentimental as he is tyrannical. As Mantell writes in one passage, "And now the sky is so clear that you can see into heaven and spy on what the saints are doing." Again, with Cromwell's beautifully imagined inner voice, she writes, "It's not just the past you think of as you ride these fields. It's what's latent in the soil, what's breeding. It's the days to come, the wars unfought, the injuries and deaths that, like seeds, the soil of England is keeping warm." Of course, we know that Henry's decision to have Cromwell killed is latent in the pages of Bring Up the Bodies, like seeds being kept warm until the third book in Hilary Mantel's trilogy is brought out by her publisher. I can hardly wait. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Barbara Quick is a screenwriter and the author of Vivaldi's Virgins and The Golden Web. You've been listening to A Novel Idea on KRCB Public Radio for Sonoma County. You can subscribe to our podcasts at www.krcb.org. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening today, and I hope you'll join us again.